The following is brought to you by Total Seal Piston Rings, the leader in ring seal technology. TotalSeal.com.
Here at Engine Performance Expo, we're still here, Lake.
We are.
We're still on. We're still up and running. Time for a little on-location hidden horsepower with our guest, Mark View. Mark, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm surrounded by history and heroes.
Well, there's a bunch of heroes out there, that's for certain.
Yeah, out there.
You're my hero. You're my hero.
Is that true? Tell us about your relationship with Mr. Speed here.
I can't remember the first time we met. I kind of vividly remember walking into your dad's engine shop. I was looking for a dyno. And you were there, and your dad was there. I didn't end up buying the dyno, but that was, I think, I knew your dad prior, but that's the first time we actually sat down and really met each other, you know, closely. It was a long
probably
time
right
ago.
In mid-90s, like that, yeah.
Gosh, it was a long time ago, man.
Yeah. It's that NASCAR history, though. So you're originally from Wisconsin, right?
I grew up in Greendale, Wisconsin, which is a suburb of Milwaukee, yeah. So I grew up at the same dirt racetrack that Alan Kulwicki drove in, Milwaukee Mile, you know. I was not part of a racing family, unlike him, but at a very early age, I decided that's what I wanted to do. So,
yes, somehow. What's the somehow? We always like to know that because it's the inspiration. What was it? Was it a moment? Was it?
All I can tell you is that I remember the moments sitting down in Milwaukee Mile watching A.J. Foyt and Parnelli Jones drive USAC stock cars. Mm-hmm. That was probably more impressive for me than watching the Indy cars that always came a week later after Indy. So that was it. And I was a drag racer too. So I would go to the drag strip. It was just, let's face it, it was, as a youngster, it was in the middle of the muscle car era. And what kid didn't want a hot rod back then? So racing was just part of it was just an extension.
I'm pretty sure it's in the water up there too.
And the cheese and the brats. Okay.
A combination of all those things, maybe so. But I mean, I'll say it. The Milwaukee Mile is one of those iconic, really amazing tracks. It's such a cool track because it's got those giant long straightaways, but yet the corners are real sweeping.
It's a tough track.
It is.
Yeah. I watched, again, A.J. Foyt monster that big old car with power steering. So I was just a kid, but it was intriguing.
It left an impression on you.
Oh, man, tremendously. You know, the noise? I mean, come on.
The sound.
It's all about the noise. It's
hearing you speak about it, I can't help but think about nowadays, kids watch movies about superheroes, the Avengers, Iron Man, it's digital, it's computers, who's got, you know, fire. You watched Heroes, too. It was A.J. Foyt out there in a
real-life Heroes.
There's a difference there. Real-life Heroes, and you followed... You followed him. A kid can't follow Iron Man because it's not real. You followed something that was real, and you made your life about it.
It was very impressionable, for certain, because you knew who they were, the icons. They're still icons, and they don't even race anymore.
Yeah.
It was an interesting time. How, what brought that passion and that desire to want to race for a living? And as a life, as a career, I think it was just a combination of all of that. And I didn't have any personal mentors. You know, my dad wasn't a racer. Nobody in my family really was involved in it. But I knew at a very young age that I wanted to build race engines for a living. And by God, that's what I did. And it didn't happen easy, but it happened. You know, so... I tell everybody, not that it makes it won't buy you half a cup of coffee, but if I wrote a book about all of the doors that opened for me, nobody would believe it. I mean, absolutely positively nobody, because it's just the mentors that were part of my life. You know, one day I sat down and I made a list of all the mentors in my career, and it was over 125 people.
Wow.
Now, these are mostly men, but men that showed me how to build engines correctly. They showed me how to race correctly. And those are things that you can't buy. You know, I was just lucky. You know, my first real race car was a AA funny car at 18. So I was racing, as it turned out, not my car because I had a partnership issue, but we ended up traveling the Midwest match racing with the Pabst Blue Ribbon Charger, which was actually the first beer-sponsored car in the history of drag racing. Okay, and
PBR, baby.
PBR. And I was just a pimple-faced kid. But I was, you know, I would be sitting in the trailer and Don Gullerz would come in and start talking and all these heroes of mine. And it's like, it was my, if I'd have died at 21, my life would have been complete. Okay, that's just the way it was. So, but you can't even plan that. You know, it's just the way it worked out. So we did a lot of traveling too. So did a lot of sleeping on the floor of a crew cab dually.
That was par racing in the day, right?
Well, I was the rookie. So the rookies had to sleep where no one else wanted to. Usually I didn't get the sleepers. So interesting time. But you know, you fight for that. You know, and you remember it. I remember every little intricate detail that I was taught working on that funny car. Because, in fact, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but even when I got involved in NASCAR, okay, there were so many stories about tires that weren't torqued during practice or wheels.
Yeah.
Weight bars that weren't screwed in when the guys would put them in. Hood latches that weren't latched and the car would go out and they'd lose a hood.
Yep.
And finally I said, I just looked at everybody on the crew. I said, enough is enough. Okay, that's not how we race. You know, so from now on, I'm torquing all the tires before they leave, and I will be the last one to work on the hood forever. And if you guys are changing anything on the car, weight or whatnot, I'm going to be right there to watch you put the bolts in. So that was my job. I was the engine builder. I was a track sport man, but I was more of a overseer when it came to the chassis guy until they understood just how important, even if you didn't like the driver, okay, there was a driver driving the car, and it was up to you to make sure that he didn't get hurt because of anything you did. And, you know, I was taught that at 17, you know, so you don't forget that stuff, you know. It's fun, it's great, but you don't want to be getting hurt.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk about that. Like, okay. That's exactly what we want to talk about.
Yeah, we don't have time to probably get through all 120 of your list today.
Forget about spark plug wires.
We'll get to it, but, no, I mean, but the thing is, so...
We are going to talk spark
to go again. Through, say, like your top three or four or five guys that were those mentors that gave you that moment that's like, wow, that door opened and this whole new career or thing happened because of that chance or whatever you want to call it.
And you said they weren't all guys. I'd be interested to see
well,
that,
too. Well, there was a bit of a hero. So when I worked for Jim Ruggles in Atlanta, Georgia, and that's when I officially moved from Milwaukee down south, Jim was involved in the Buick Grand National program, and he also was previously involved in the Chrysler Hemi development. So a very smart engine man, a bit of a curmudgeon, but he liked me, and I liked him, and he would communicate with me. And I would say he had a female engine builder. Her name was Tomoka Brady. And Tomoka had a PhD in business, if I remember right. And, you know, the first lady I ever met in an engine shop, period, working in an engine shop. And she was awesome. I mean, she was meticulous. We'd have competition together. She was great to work with, but she loved what she did. She would write little notes on the bottom of the intake manifolds. She was a fan of Harry Gant, and we won a lot of races with Harry Gant. She'd write, good luck, Harry, at the Charlotte race and this and that. You know, it's kind of goo-goo stuff, right? But the embarrassing part is when he would win the races, or even, you know, Rusty or whoever we did motors for, is they display all the parts on the table.
Right.
So
NASCAR
you'd see those little love notes on the bottom of the manifold. It was a little embarrassing. Okay. But you'd have to know Tomoka. You know, she's a great lady. I have no idea where she's at now. But so let's fast forward, okay, to all the shops that I managed as head engine builder. If I had to do it all over again, and I mean this with all the love I can muster up, I would look at women to work in the engine shops. And I don't hold that against any man that wants to work in an engine shop, but I'm telling you, they're so meticulous. We have seven ladies of different ages that work in our shipping department. I have one that works in manufacturing, and I'm telling you, they run the show. They run the show because they care, they're passionate. You know, they know what life's like a little bit.
Detail oriented.
Most of them are stay-at-home moms, you know, so they've been through that a little bit. And it's like, it's a great place for me to be. You know, I tell everybody I clean toilets and I sign checks. That's all I do.
That's amazing.
But that whole, you know, that whole business, that was a gift.
Okay? So Ruggles, that was the V6 era.
V6 from Ruggles. I went to Ernie's and worked for Ernie. We helped develop the V6 Ford Push Grand National Engine.
Ernie, as in Ernie Elliott. Elliott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ernie
so talk Elliott. About that for a second, because that's a big name yeah. by itself.
So yeah, how did it work?
Or? I hear he knows how to make power.
It's kind of famous. Yeah. Elliott guys.
I would drive an hour and a half one way to work for Ernie Elliott. I lived in Loganville, Georgia, and Dawsonville was an hour and a half away. So a lot of times I would sleep at the shop. But he hired me to work on the V6 Ford program and help design it and build engines for Bill initially. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately we started building motors for his son, for Casey. But that was an experience. Got to work with Ford, Mose Nolan, whom I'm
yes.
sure you remember.
Yep.
He was like the epitome of the kind of engineer you'd love to work with. And I fell in love with the Ford program. And it was just really nice.
And people may not understand it, but even at that time, the Bush series, right? The V6 wasn't in Cup.
No.
But that Bush series, that was a struggle. That was a hard-fought competition.
Oh,
he had
yes.
guys like Keith Simmons and a whole bunch of other people,
yeah.
local guys from all yeah. around the country were battling it out. It wasn't just like, oh, well, it's minor league baseball.
No.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it was still pretty intense competition.
It was Winston Cup with a six-cylinder. I mean, you had extraordinary drivers. You had extraordinary crew chiefs and teams. A lot of those teams were part-time teams sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't huge budgets. The engine programs were, NASCAR claimed that we were going to race the V6s in Cup. And I think
that was a long-term idea, obviously.
Yeah, that was the idea. But I think that whole deal was ash-canned after their ears rang a week later after Bristol. Because I would wear earplugs and radios. And I would still go home with my ears ringing for days on end. Because there was just a frequency that was just almost unbearable. But as far as the engine itself and the development of the engine and its ability to talk to you as a development engineer, it was phenomenal. It was actually one of the most fun, most responding engines I've ever worked with in my career.
Expand on that, how it would talk to you.
Well, back in the day, we didn't have AVL dynos, at mm-hmm. least not in NASCAR
right.
at the time. So our data acquisition systems were
more crude,
like crude to primitive. Say the least. So you had a tool, and you used that tool as much as you could. The thing about the V6, and I say this, and is you could make minute changes, and it would define whether or not the change was viable or not. And I think part of it was the reduced amount of friction, obviously, in the engine. So it was able to respond. I did tremendous amount of spark plug work, tremendous amount of header work with the V6s. And if I chose to do that kind of development on the V8s, I didn't get the response that I did with the V6s. Now, I know that might sound silly, and I'm not going to go into necessarily the technical reasons behind it, but it was one of those engines that it was just sweet to work with. And it only had 8 head bolts, you know? So
right.
That's what I love about the Fords, the early Fords, that they had 10 head bolts on each side. It's easy to rebuild. You know, you're not going to lose count. And never had a failure with head gaskets or anything. So, you know, then we had to go and get smarter and start putting, you know, 35 bolts on top of the cylinder. old school stuff. But, yeah, it was a tremendous, again, that's one of those knock on the door, and that literally was a knock on the door. Okay. I talk about the magic of my little insignificant career. When I left Jim Ruggles, it wasn't because of any other reason except that he financially couldn't afford my health insurance anymore. I had 3 children. So I said, okay, I got to do something different. So I took a day off. I drove up to Dawsonville. I knocked on the door. It was locked. There were glass doors. And just as I knocked on the door, Ernie Elliott walks by. He opens the door and says, can I help you? And I explained who I was and why I'm there. And he knew Jim very well, so there was no animosity. It's just I gave him the truth. And he said, follow me. And he pointed to an engine that was literally resting in a pile of oil, okay? And said, that's my V6 right now. And I said, okay, not what I expected, okay? And 30 minutes later, he hired me. And he didn't even know how to spell my last name. Okay, but he hired me, and then the first day I went there the following week or two, he said, oh, by the way, we have to test Daytona in 3 weeks. And it's like, really? And we don't have a motor yet. So needless to say, the barn door was open, and Mark spent a lot of time there, and I spent many a night sleeping there as well. Because you had to. You did what you had to do. I don't want to meddle for doing that. I did it because I wanted to do it. But that's what you do. You know, that's what your dad did. Right. That's what you did. That's what all of the racers did and still do. I mean, they do whatever you have to do to get the job done. And it was an experience. You can't go to school and learn this stuff. Okay? You have to do it. And later on, I did go back to college, but I went back to college with all of this stuff, you know, in my brain. So it was very helpful. So, yeah. So from there, Ernie decided that he was going to do something different with Casey, and we had Casey was going to go Busch Granite. Casey being Ernie's son, we had three brand new Busch cars. He had raced Busch a little bit, and we had two chassis. We had eight engines. And Ernie was done. He didn't want to deal with the Busch stuff anymore. So we took all that stuff and we took it to Lincolnton, North Carolina, and we started a shop with Radius Motorsports and Tim Fedewa. So that was Tim Fedewa's first Busch ride. So I ran the Busch shop all by myself, the engine shop. I went to the racetrack. I did everything. But I had eight engines. So I had enough engines ahead of time so I could do rebuilds and do whatever development work we had. That was actually the old Skull Bandit shop that Harold Elliott used to run.
Oh, yeah.
So that was history in itself. And that's where I met Harold. So you want to talk about mentors. Harold is no longer with us, but Harold took me under his wing. You know, he showed me the politics of NASCAR, and we got along very well. Now, keep in mind, I'm a Yankee, okay? I'm a bit of an engineer, and I'm in NASCARville. Okay, that wasn't a good mix. Okay, now I married a Southern lady, so that makes me half Southern, and I love the South. So please don't take that anyway. But it was tough politically. You know, I had to keep my mouth shut and I had to listen. His dad was one of those guys that I did a lot of listening. You know, he taught me a lot of stuff and he doesn't even know it. You know, so we did that program, and then we ended up doing the Cup program for Jimmy Hensley and for Ted Musgrave, and ultimately ended up working for Laird Wallace at PowerTech.
He's an amazing guy.
If you looked at my resume, you'd say this guy can't keep a job. But but the problem is in racing back then is, you know, there was only really a few well-financed teams out there, and everybody else's program was based on a 1 or 2 year sponsorship program. So at the end of sometimes 1 year, 2 years, you know, you're finishing the last race, whether or not there's going to be money to go racing the next year. And sometimes there wasn't, you know. That doesn't mean the team wasn't viable and they weren't competitive. It just means they didn't have the sponsor money to do it. So.
That's 100% truth. That's basically the story of my dad's career.
Yeah.
Is that you didn't have those big long-term sponsorship deals. You had, a lot of times it was that small company that was aspirational.
Right.
That they bet their marketing budget on NASCAR, that was going to catapult their business, and that could become more. And a lot of times they would have growth, but it wouldn't hit the home run. Like they could hit a double with their sponsorship deal, which was great.
That's right.
But it didn't hit a grand slam that they were hoping for. So then they're gone. So now you're back to zero again.
Oh yeah.
And it was that same cycle.
I mean, it was tough for drivers. It was tough for, it was tough for car owners. You know, you build a team. You know, you have all the equipment, all the cars, all the people, and you have to shut the doors. And then you have auctions, and that was not always a pretty sight either, you know. So, that was just life in the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, it was.
Good or bad, that's just the way it was.
But, you know, Larry Wallace, he's been a guest on Hidden Horsepower.
Oh, Larry's
and he's a fantastic guy, so I would love to hear more about
him. Well, he's another one of my mentors. I mean, Larry, you know, Larry raced, he and I raced against each other in Cup, and we spent a lot of time on pit wall talking. And I'll tell you a quick funny story. When I went to work with Larry, you know, we used to look at spark plugs. No, this was even before I worked with him. We would compare spark plugs all the time. That's all we had. We didn't have NASCAR wouldn't allow us anything, okay? You had to do everything by the seat of your pants, essentially. So we're looking at spark plugs, and one day he tells me he's colorblind. Yeah, I don't think the world knows that, but Larry Wallace is colorblind. So, Larry, how can you read a spark plug if you don't see color? Well, I get by. And if you have to know Larry that he could get by. Yeah. Larry was an extraordinary engine builder. And his perspective on how to build engines and the technology behind it was it was simple. You know, his perspective was, it was a different way that he approached problems differently than I did. And he approached it from a much simpler way. And it all made more sense. And he taught me a lot of that stuff. You know, I mean, if you go to a situation like that and you come out saying, I didn't learn anything, then you didn't do your homework, you know. Great man. He had a great team. He ultimately ended up running Penske.
Yep.
In program, sold it to. And which is funny because I ultimately ended up running the Jasper program, which eventually became
the Penske program.
Yeah. So somewhere I was stuck in there, and it was all good, you know. I love the industry. I'd be building engines now if it was in my DNA today, but I build spark plug wires now. For engine builders.
Well, I think that's the great part is that you have that knowledge base.
Yeah.
So when you talk to a whole litany of people, like you said, you're talking about Joe Creason earlier, right? And Ronnie at Wall to Wall. So we have all these different customers in common we know that are engine guys. Well, I think one of the things that they really appreciate about you is you've been in their shoes.
Oh, my gosh.
And so you can speak this exact same language, and it makes it easier for them to deal with you and trust that, hey, I think,
and that's important, if I may, and that's all I want our customers to know or our future customers to know, is that when they buy our product, they have to understand that I look at this meager spark plug wire just like they would look at a piston, a crankshaft, or a cylinder head, okay, because that's what we do, okay? We critique everything that goes on top of that engine or inside that engine, and that's my perspective as well. And the spark plug wire is the last thing to go on an engine, and it's also one of the last things that these engine builders forget to order, okay? So what's the recipe of the day is you get a phone call that motor's going on the dyno and I need wires. You take care of them. We still get that to this day, okay? So our company was really, it was our company, thanks to Brian Scott, who started the company 38 years ago, he catered to the engine builders. That was his love. And we have, and obviously he and I were best friends, and we got along. I helped him as much as I could, and we've carried that on. You know, we could, it doesn't make any difference, but we could become a $20 million company. But as long as I'm involved in the company, we're going to take care of those guys first. Now, I don't mean first, but they're going to be taken care of. Whatever they need and whatever amount of time they need it, okay, so relatively quick delivery, we're going to do it, okay, and we're going to do it their way, whatever. We've got small block Chevrolet under header. We've got almost 400 engine builders that we deal with. And I could say out of those 400 engine builders, about 300 of them have a variation of a small block Chevrolet underheader. It might differ 1 inch, but that's the way they want it, so that's the way we build it. So that's just the nature. That's who we are.
Why spark plug wires? Like after this amazing career that you had, how did you end up in that of all the different areas?
If you're interested in who I am, I'll let you know. So after PowerTech, I talked I decided I was going to start my own business, and I wanted to build cup engines for a living as well. I mean, why not? I was surrounded by it. And I started a company, spent every penny I had, and I was about a quarter of an inch away from signing a very lucrative Bush program with Michael Waltrip. At the time, sponsor wanted Jack Roush. I realized that I couldn't compete with these guys. I mean, just from a marketing standpoint, I couldn't compete with them. Technically, it wasn't a problem, but marketing was a problem. So I had to close the doors. I sold my house to pay my bills, and Jasper called me a week later and needed a head engine builder. And again, if I told you the story, in a book, nobody would believe it. And we ran the Jasper program for several years and had a good time, learned a lot. It was our entry into Veltrain Dynamics, so we were one of the first teams to have a Spintron. We were one of the first teams to have a ferro arm in our cup shop. So we were, the Jasper team was a highly sophisticated race team, both in the engine shop and in the chassis shop. We just didn't get all the eggs together, you know? I mean, there's some phenomenal people. But after that, I went to work for Carl Wagner.
That's okay? where I met you.
And Carl was an incredible man. We got along very well. And I moved to the Stavola Brothers shop. We developed the Wagner South program. We built motors for Cup and Busch, mm-hmm. mostly Busch and truck, and worked with Carl for 5 years. And after that, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. Okay, so I ended up actually getting involved in drag racing. So I ended up building and actually started two pro stock engine shops in town, and probably worked in pro stock, NHRA pro stock, for about 4 years, 5 years. And
one of those, Shane Gray?
One of those was Shane Gray. The other one was Jakes. The other was Mike. How could I forget Mike's name? He won a championship. Edwards. Okay. And so, you know.
I've heard of those guys.
Great experience.
Yes, you have.
Great
I've
experience.
I've heard of those guys.
Great people. Just, you know, I just.
That's also around that same time when the pro stock guys kind of realized, hey, this guy's in NASCAR country. They know a few things.
Oh, yeah.
Especially we're turning more RPM, and all of a sudden now where there weren't any pro stock shops in Cupland, now all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of them in Cupland.
I think everybody that has followed certainly the pro stock programs throughout the years can attest to the fact that it was NASCAR technology that brought the improvements to pro stock. Okay, pro stock engine building, I have respect for everybody that was involved in it, but it was a little latent compared to some of the technology that we learned in Cup. And all we had to do was change the numbers, okay, and the stuff started reacting. You know, it's something as simple as piston rings, okay, and beyond. But that was all technical stuff. And that's if you have that foundation, you know, you can pretty much go anywhere with it. And I did. I got involved after I left the pro stock situation. I actually went to work for a company, alternative fuel engine company, and I was essentially the designer for the company and the CEO, if you will. And that won't buy a half a cup of coffee. But it was a propane-fired engine that we were going to introduce to the market, and we were sponsored by an oil company. And that's when oil, at the time, we were there for 2 years, and all of a sudden, you know, a barrel of oil went down to 3 cents. And needless to say, we lost our fund. We lost our sponsor. Okay. Imagine that. We lost our sponsor.
surprise.
So I went into consulting for a while. And then Scott Performance Wire, who was, again, started by my best friend, Brian Scott. I look at Brian every day and I thank him. He died about 8 years ago. He owned the company for 30. He's the one that did all the foundation work. He built the brand. I tell everybody he left me an uncut diamond. And all we do every day is polish it. That's all we do. We polish it with people, we polish it with maybe some technology and a little bit of the experience that we have, and we've taken it certainly to a different place, but it's still his company. You know, I still work for him. Brian was a great friend, but he was a curmudgeon. We could never work together, but he was a great man, a great philanthropist. He gave away more money to charities than I can tell you. But I think everybody in the business knew him. You know, he did wires for everybody. Certainly NASCAR. He did about 75% of the product during the day, and he worked every day, all by himself. You know, he's a one man band. But we have seven, eight people in shipping. We have 5 to 6 people in manufacturing, and we built the company up to where it can supply to these, you know, everybody. You know, we do private labeling. We're an international company now. But you know, the foundation is the engine builders. You know, whether they're, you know, it's a one set deal or a 100 set deal, it makes no difference. We'll take care of them. That's who we are. We're racers. Sorry. No. I have to apologize for that, right?
No, you don't. Not here. Not here, you don't.
I'm just kidding.
Not anywhere.
No, I'm just kidding. Racers. I love the sport. I love the industry. I've been in forever. You know, and it's an industry that if you're not involved in it, you can't explain it to somebody else.
Because that's true.
And we were eating lunch together. It's like 99% of the people that I've known in this industry, whether it's technical sales, whether it's companies, no matter what it was, there were people that you'd take a bullet for, and those people would do the same for you. And there's not an industry quite like that, okay? Because we all kind of do the same thing. I mean, we all do this to win the race, okay? But we all know we're not going to win every race, but we still try to do that.
Right.
And it's phenomenal. Yeah, I'm going to start crying if I talk about it more because it is.
Well, it's the people, right? We keep on saying it's the people that make this industry so wonderful, and that's
exactly
what's
right.
Fantastic about the Engine Performance Expo is it gives us a chance to get people together who are just engine guys, just to focus on engine stuff. So we got tons more engine stuff coming your way, so stay tuned.